Hey everybody, welcome back to the podcast. This is show number 111, and this week's guest is Bob St. Cyr. Hey everybody, welcome back to the Lensless Podcast. We're here today. Andrew, how are you?
Yes, I'm all right. Yeah. Yes, thank
this
you.
This is show 111.
Yeah, that's called Nelson in cricket. Did you know that?
I did not.
If a team is on 1-1-1, the umpire, the guy who does the scoring and the umpiring, he stands on one leg.
Oh, I didn't know that.
It's an unlucky number. Any combination 2-2-2, 1-1-1, and teams are very worried. They need to get past that score quickly. Otherwise, they feel they're going to get out. You see all the...
Is it the kiss of death?
Yeah. 1-1-1. So that doesn't bode well for this show, does it?
We'll be all right.
Just as well we've been saved by an excellent guest.
Yeah. Why don't you introduce him?
I thought you were going to introduce him because I want to hear you butcher his name.
No, I'm not going to.
Well, shall I introduce him then? We're very pleased to be joined by Bob St. Cyr. Hello, Bob.
Hey, Bob.
Hi. Hello.
Hello, Bob. Bob is way, way, way from me, and a bit closer from Curry, but he's over in British Columbia.
I'm in the middle.
You're in the middle. Curry's on the East Coast.
Yeah.
Bob is over. You're a bit east of Vancouver, I think, aren't you, Bob?
Yeah, just about an hour east of Vancouver.
Is it a very rural area where you live?
No, it's Abbotsford's a city, a small. I guess I would call it a mid-sized city, and a lot of agriculture around here. So a lot of blueberry farms.
Cool.
Well, farms that grow those little fruit that I put on my breakfast. Those blueberries,
blueberries, strawberries, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So is your? I lived in Seattle for a while, Bob. So do you get that kind of dreary winter? Socked in, misty, rainy, cool days.
You got it.
Winter, yeah.
But today is an exception. Today, this weekend, is supposed to be very nice and sunny, and I can see the sun's just coming up now. So, cool.
Yeah. Well, a bit later on, I want to talk to you about the weather because I was listening to one of your podcasts, and it was called Notes from the Field, when you painted a wonderful picture as you were describing standing. There was a lake and a tree stump, and you had like 2 minute exposures, 4 minute exposures, 8 minute exposures, and so it went on in different films. And you were talking about it being quite overcast, so we'll come on to that because I want to talk to you about lensless long exposures and lensed long exposures.
Okay.
Anyway, why don't you start by?
Andrew.
Yes, mate.
What have you been up to?
Don't worry, nothing much.
Okay.
No, don't worry. Don't worry about what I've been up to. Nothing much. There's loads to talk to with Bob.
Okay. All right,
you're
Bob.
Happy. Let's focus on. We normally have this little toing and froing about what we've been doing, Bob. You know. But there's loads to talk about. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and
pinhole journey
and your pinhole journey? Yeah. Well, photography journey, really. I guess.
Yeah. Sure.
Okay, sure. I guess like what got me interested in photography was I think it was a high school science fair, and I was just starting high school junior high school at that time, and so you had all these different clubs with their what they do presented out in the big gymnasium. So you'd have different clubs and different organizations showing what they do and different clubs you could join, like, you know, there's sports clubs, and then there was a photography club. So I went over and had a look at some of the things that they have, and I got interested from there. I remember, I think back sheepishly now, how I was intimidated by the little Ricoh 500G camera we used to have. And I'm going, oh my goodness, how I've moved on from that. But it was a very slow start, but I kept at it. Must have made all the mistakes you can make processing film. And I just, you know, learned from that. I just kept going with that, and eventually was able to buy my own camera. And that time it was the, what was available? There wasn't a lot available. There was a Canon AE-1 program. And so that's what I started with. My photographic journey started with that, that camera.
A lot of people did, I think.
Yeah. Well, you know, I came from a small prairie town, and the closest city, you know, was about an hour away in the prairie. And they didn't have a lot of offerings, but that was one that was there that I could do. So that's what I ended up getting. And I really liked working with that camera.
Yeah. The Canon AE-1 and the Pentax K1000, I think, was probably was people's first use, you know, first camera.
Yeah. I just wish it had a little bit more, you know, I think it was a shutter priority, if I'm not mistaken. So it would have been nice to have aperture priority too, because there are different times when you need the different exposure modes. So that would have been nice, but it was a good camera to start with.
Yeah. And then I guess that led you into pinhole.
Yeah, well, pinhole was interesting. I started pinhole probably in the, when was that? The mid-90s, I think. I had taken an old Mamiya, I believe it was a Mamiya film box or film packaging, and I took a piece of photographic film, and I had made a pinhole camera with that, made an exposure, and got an exposure, got an image. I still have that image. Cool. And then I put it away for years. And then I didn't come back to it. That was probably around 90, 95, 96. And then I didn't come back to it till about 2007, I think. I keep seeing these ads on APUG. And then there was a website called F295, which I joined. And so I thought, okay, I'll give it a try. So back about that time, I ordered a pinhole camera. And just never look back.
Cool. What did you order? What could you buy back in the day?
At that time, in I think I got one of Zernicki's cameras.
Oh, the Zeros. Mm,
cool. Yeah. I think I got a. I think it was the 4x5. He had the 4x5s. Mm-hmm. So I got that. I bought the deluxe version, so it has the spacers. So I got it with the two spacers, the 25 millimeter spacers.
Wrapped it with rubber bands to keep it together.
Yeah. He sent the rubber bands, and then since then I've looked, and I can get rubber bands for that. So I started with that, and I like that because I could change my focal length. And you know, I like working with pinhole. I don't like small. For me, bigger is better with pinhole. So I usually work with 4x5 or 120 when I'm working with that pinhole. I also have the 0-image 6.9 camera as well. And then the latest one I got was a Vermeer anamorphic. Mm-hmm. That one's a challenge to use. That one's a bit tougher to use. And then I got the pinhole blender, which I thoroughly enjoy using as well. Working with that,
I've been really interested to hear your experience with that, because Chris sent me the 120 pinhole blender, and I've put one roll of film for it a year or so ago, and I've got another one sitting in the darkroom ready for developing, and I'm yet to work out quite how to use it. I got an image of three. I read the instructions and spoke to him, and I got some images of all three pinholes, you know, focusing on the negative at the same time. I know there's different things you can do with it, but I quite like the idea of incorporating three elements. But it's choosing the subject and knowing what works and what doesn't, I think.
Yeah, and for that, I prefer to use an E6 film, and that might make some people cringe because there's no room for air with slide film. Mm-hmm. It's really tough. And then if you're working pinhole, it's even more difficult. But I usually don't think about that. I usually just see what's before me and what I want to photograph. I like it for, especially the, for example, the 4x5 in the ultra wide angle, the 25mm, without any spacers. I like shooting rhododendrons with that.
Yeah.
And getting right up close.
Does the zero have bad? Is the fall off pretty bad with it? With no extensions?
I didn't notice it too much. Yes, there is fall off. Yeah, absolutely. But I guess it's also how you compose too. Like if you get right in there, like get the camera right up close as possible, you're going to fill the frame with more of that image and not allow a lot of extraneous light from the outside.
Sure.
That's one way. I mean, you're not going to get rid of it. The law of optics
it's always going to be there. So
it is. But I mean, what I like about it is that it allows me to, it's not boring. Pinhole is not boring because it allows me to stretch and move with the light. It's like light is almost plasticine like, and that's why I like working with pinhole, because it's not just, you know, a straight plane here with a film or a sensor and a straight plane here with a lens or an optic. It's, you know, it allows you to move a bit, especially with the blender. Getting back to the blender, it curves the 120 film inside the camera while you're blending the images too. So you'll notice the light in the image is distorted, it's stretched, and I kind of like that effect. And then when they're blending the images, especially if it's color, that's wonderful. I had a article published on pinhole work in Canadian Camera magazine several years ago, and on the title page for the article, they used one of my blender shots that was made with colored film, and it's just beautiful watching the colors blend in together. It was flowers. I had photographed a bunch of flowers at a park, and it's really, I find it really works well with color. Color negative film, I'm not too sure. I don't use that a lot. I'm primarily black and white most of the time, and then for color, I would use E6.
Well, you're in a bit of a minority, aren't you, with E6?
Yes.
Over the years, Corey, the guests we've had on here, I'm just thinking...
only a few.
The man behind the Terrapins, Todd.
Todd Schlemmer?
Yeah, Todd Schlemmer uses slide film.
Mm-hmm.
I've put one roll through, I think, and got pretty good results.
Lorraine Healy does too. She uses slide film.
Yeah.
Does she use that as much as... Is that mainly slide film she uses, or is she using print film as well?
I thought it was slide film.
No, you may well be right. But there's not many folks... Mainly, probably because of the cost as well, though.
Yeah.
Ooh, yeah, that's becoming quite dear, the cost of a slide film. So... I don't use it a lot of the time, but I do have some for when I need it. Like right now, autumn, a beautiful time for slide film. And, the more, as you use it too, you become more, you begin to understand light and read light and understand how your materials work. So if you're used to working with a certain material, hopefully over time, you'll understand the characteristics of that material and, you know, combining that knowledge with the help of your exposure meter.
What slide film do you use?
A Provia 100
at present. Cool. I was going to say, up there where you are, if you got a lot of those yellows and leaves changing, that Velvia probably would be good too.
Yeah, I tried to find, I've been looking for some Velvia. I've contacted a couple of stores. I wanted to find some Velvia 50 because the 100 is taboo now. So I just hard to find.
Which is the one that's, so there's one that's just been withdrawn in the US market because of chemicals, isn't there? And then there's some others just been in the news recently as well, isn't there?
Right. The chemical, the one removed because of the chemistry, that was the 100. I don't know if labs are going to touch that one anymore. But the 50, they've just announced they're discontinuing the 50. So that's the one I was trying to find in sheet film. And I was told it's not even listed in the catalog anymore. So
wow.
I think it was always hard to get because Ben Horn, who's a large format photographer on YouTube, he'll use it. And I think he would get it, and some other people have posted about getting it from Amazon via the Amazon Japan website, but obviously it's a little bit tricky because it's all in Japanese.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a big issue for me. I like working with Provia. I get some really nice punchy colors with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not over the top like Velvia might be, and so, but it's sufficient.
What tips would you give me and others who want to do this sort of blending? So you can buy one of Chris's, go to pinholeblender.com and look at Chris's cameras that he makes, which are just lovely. Or you could get a biscuit tin and fashion one yourself, I would think.
Yes.
But Chris's are very cleverly designed, and you've got winding knobs on and so on and so forth.
Yes.
What sort of subjects, if I'm using black and white film, because I can't see myself using much color slide film just because of the cost, what sort of subjects work well? Would it be cityscapes, I would have thought, with a combination of buildings and people walking might be quite good?
Yeah, I think that would be quite good. You know, whatever subjects that you're passionate about. I would like to, you know, I probably will expand into, you know, more urban landscapes, but I've liked working with nature quite a bit with it. I've had some success with that. I mean, there is some that don't turn out, of course, but, you know, you learn from those things. I think that's really important to have those mistakes to learn from them as well. Because I'm using color, I prefer to work with, you know, nature, flowers, trees, those kind of things. But with black and white, I think it would be, make some brilliant images working with urban landscapes.
I think the point you made about working with materials and learning them over time is right, because I've only used the blender a couple of times and I just need to get out there really in my landscape and use it more. And I'm sure after a few rolls, I'll begin to see what works and what doesn't.
Exactly. Let's not talk about it. You know, bring the podcast and listen to it with your earbuds, but get out there and make pictures while you're listening to the podcast. That's like perfect. That's the thing, is get out there and practice your art. And that's, I think, really important. I mean, we can talk about it and we can read books about it, but you got to get out and practice it. And, you know, that's, I think, the important aspect of it. That's one of the things that makes photography so wonderful. And then when you're doing pinhole, one of the interesting things I've noticed is that people will come up and want to talk and want to know what you've got. What is that, you know, kind of thing. That's pretty interesting too.
Yeah, I get, definitely. I've had all kinds of stuff. But people would ask me, what are you doing?
Yeah.
I get challenged out where I live because it's a rural farmland area. And, you know, that, and I haven't got an agricultural vehicle. I'm driving around in a sort of urban car. And I'll be, sometimes I'll be stopping outside farm buildings, outside houses, and just, I guess, looking really suspicious, you know, because I'm looking at the potential of a scene. And then when I, normally, when I'm at that stage, I'll get challenged by a farmer. More recently, I just finished photographing with my Toyo large format camera, and I was stood on the roadside, and there was a fence, and I was photographing over the fence at this barn, you know, straight on at this barn, and I packed everything away, so there was no evidence that I was a photographer. And this lady pulled up, and she was kind of passive aggressive, if you know what I mean. Like, can I help you?
Yeah.
I own this barn. Basically, what are you doing? And the only way I could pacify her really was to pick up my Toyo and said, well, I've been using this. Oh, she said.
I think that's the way it is for street photography too. I think it's much more, it's a different world today than it was when, you know, when Vivian Meyer was photographing, or Brissot. It's just a different world, isn't it?
It is, and it goes for not just, everyone's so suspicious, and I suppose photographs are so prolific, aren't they? You know, they're just everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, I was reading a book written in the 80s, and the photographer there was talking about the proliferation of images, and that was before the internet. So goodness, you know. And you can't photograph kids now. You know, look at all the wonderful photographs, wonderful, powerful, completely innocent from a sexual point of view, photographs of kids over the years. But, you know, you just can't.
Yeah.
Yep.
So you could, do you have, I was just thinking of something else, you know, for the blender, maybe photographing automobiles, like if you're photographing classic automobiles, you know, with a lot of chrome, and if it's depending on the lighting, that might make some interesting compositions as well.
Yeah. I'm going to have to get out and play with it more.
Yeah. Or if you're in a rural area, I'm just thinking, what about farm machinery, different pieces of farm machinery, of course, with permission from the farmers.
Yeah, I think the first role I put through it was at a campsite I was staying at, and they had, it was a not a very upmarket campsite. It had old boats and cranes and things parked on the side, and I used those. And I found the image was a bit muddled. You know, you couldn't quite see what was what. It needed more, somehow needed more cohesion. So I think I just need to think a little bit about it.
Mm-hmm. If you were at a campsite, you should have made a fire and used your fire, done it with the fire.
Yeah, probably.
For like 2 hour exposure, just so that it's at the.
Well, that's the nice thing also about Pinhole is it allows us for the capture, the passing of time as well. So you mm-hmm. can photograph a scene and not have to worry about people because if the exposure is long enough, they're going to disappear anyway. Like that early photograph, I don't know if you remember, there's one of the first photographs made of someone getting a shoe shine.
Yes.
Yeah. I know
the streets look empty. So.
But they weren't, were they?
No, but I mean, that would be kind of an interesting shot too. Like you're photographing something that's very, very busy, you know, and then because of your exposure, there's the people are not.
Well, I'd like to, I don't live in a city. So next time I go to a city or a more built up area, I think I'll take it with me in a tripod and I'll put up with the looks and the questions, because I would think, you know, the combination of the buildings, the hard edges, brick and steel, whatever, and then people moving. I wouldn't want them to disappear completely, but I'd like some movement. You know, I know Corey's a fan of movement. You don't like people disappearing completely, do you?
Mm-mm, I don't. I like to see them
a little bit.
And I think it speaks of people moving through time. You know, and if they're not there, then you don't really know, do you? You know, you don't know if there's people there or not.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing you have is you've got 3 pinholes to open up and expose with the pinhole blender as well. And so what I have done is I've tried to open them up, you know, at the same time. And then I've tried, just opening one at a time and timing my exposure. And I guess you just have to find a technique that's going to work for you, that you find, you know, easiest for your workflow.
Yeah. So, and it's getting those sticky bits off. Well, I've just got the little magnetic things that cover it at the moment, so you're getting those off without shaking the whole camera as well.
Yeah, and the thing with the magnets is that if you're not using the camera for some period of time, they're kind of really stuck, so you might want to move them up and down a little bit to loosen them so that when it does come to the exposure, they just slide easily, because like I say, if you're not using it for a while, they do kind of get fixated on that position, so you might have to work with them a little bit.
So just for people at home who were kind of wondering, not exactly sure, the blender is not like the anamorphic camera, right? There's 3 separate pinholes that you're literally blending together, as opposed to the anamorphic cameras that I have has like a pinhole on each end, right?
Yeah. The anamorphic is it's coming in at an angle.
Yeah.
And it's just coming straight in from the pinhole blender. It's coming straight in on that curved piece of film.
Yeah. But you have 3 different pinholes to shoot, so you can theoretically do 3 different scenes, right? You know, and kind of blend them together, I guess, is the
plan. You could move it and do that, yeah.
Cool.
The possibilities are endless, really, aren't they?
You have one, Andrew, don't you? You just haven't used it.
I do. I have used it. I've used it twice.
not as much as Bob, though.
It's in fact, I've got it out, and it's on top of my typewriter behind me.
What's the pinhole size? What is it? Is it 275?
I can't remember. It's such a long time since I used it. Oh, I've got it. Have I got it written on? F200.
Yeah, I got you. That's cool.
I've got it written on with a Sharpie on the bottom.
So that's still, even if it's bright out, that's still going to be kind of a longer exposure, unless you're using super fast film, you know?
Yeah. Well, F200's about, you know, most of my cameras, my commercial 6x6 cameras and even the 4x5, they're all in that sort of bracket from 150 to 250.
But I've gotten to the point now with pinhole that I don't even go out in the middle of the day. It's either earlier or subdued light, you know, or later in the day, you know, so I'm already doing longer exposures right off the bat.
Yeah, but that is that because you're just at work all the time?
Well, yeah, no, not that. I don't like the real fast pinhole pictures. I like it when it's 5 to 10 to 15 seconds, so the leaves on the trees kind of blur, you know, and like,
yeah.
I mean, I, for me, I like looking at the, I mean, the other photography that people are doing looks great, you know, of course. But whenever I go out to shoot, I try to like try to
yeah
get it close for longer exposure, you know, for what I like to do.
I love those moments where, particularly with like the smaller 6x6 cameras, like the Reality So Subtle or whatever it might be, or the Zero, maybe not so much the Zero, because it's well, no, you could leave the shutter open on that. But mm-hmm. I like the ones where you can, where you're out for a meal with folks. I've done it with like 30 people, and I've set it up and just forgotten about it, you know, and folks are in their chairs and they've mm-hmm. all kind of, they're kind of gone blurry, and you can see.
It's kind of cool when you can like see their shoulders, because they kind of sit in the yeah. same position, but their heads move, you know, like yeah, they yeah. kind of come back to that same spot, and it'll, you know.
But I don't never bother timing it. I mean, sometimes, you know, you're in a restaurant and it's dark and there's not much light anyway. You just, and I've just mm-hmm. left it for an hour. Hour and a half sometimes. And,
yeah. So, you know. So Bob, what do you, out where you're at, you have a lot of subdued light and long, dreary winters, right? Like
the winters. Your, yeah.
What do you, what's your kind of, I don't want to say preferred, because a lot of times we all have life, and some days you only have these 2 hours to go and do it. So you have to deal mm-hmm. with whatever you have at that time. You know what I mean? But what's your general preference of getting out and trying to make images?
Just, you know, if it's not raining.
Yeah, sure.
You know, this is kind of our rainy season now we're into. This weekend is a special gift, I guess, because it's sunny out, mm. which is, we haven't seen that for a little while. So, yeah, if it's not raining, I like to get out. Even, I think it was last week or the week before, I wanted to go out and get some pictures. The Frugal Film Project really helps, you know, push you to get out and make some images at least once a month. So going out to do that. And then our darkroom group also has a theme. And so trying to get those shots. And I went out and it was overcast. It was still raining on and off, but I didn't mind. I mean, I was, you know, you go to work, come home. It's nice to get out with the cameras once in a while. Sure. Well,
I don't think we see enough pinhole pictures in the rain. There must be loads of possibilities, you know, for you could just
or,
stand
or the
there
rain's
under an umbrella.
Gone and you don't even see it because it's such a long exposure. How do you know if it's in the rain? Mm.
Yeah. Well, that's true.
Or maybe from mounting the camera in your automobile on your window.
Yeah.
Perhaps you could do it that way as well.
So yeah. Bob, you started a podcast a while back called Follow the Light, which is yeah. just a great title. What? Why did you decide to call it Follow the Light? It's probably self-explanatory, but there might be a more cryptic reason.
No, actually, it has a double meaning. It has two meanings. So the primary meaning comes from the book of St. John, chapter 8, verse 12.
And I did wonder.
Jesus again unto them, you know, and he's the light, so we follow him, and mm-hmm. That's the key for mankind. So that was the primary meaning. And, you know, it's something if people ask for, I'll say it. And, you know, then Jesus spake unto them, and I am the light of the world. He that followeth me shall not walk in darkness, for he hath the light of life. And then the secondary meaning would be follow the light. There's no light. There's no photography without light. So
there you go.
You have to have light for photography. So I thought absolutely. That would make a good title.
Mm-hmm. It's really good, because if you want to talk about faith, then you don't have to just bring it up. But with a title like that, it sometimes folks ask you, don't they?
Exactly. If people bring it up, that's fine. And we can take that as far as not as they want. And, yeah. you know.
So. I did wonder, because I was listening to, which one was it? I think it was the Notes from the Field episode where you were out, which I think is a favorite area with a tree stump and some water and some
yep.
cloudy skies. So long exposures. You were using
yep.
Lomachrome?
Yeah,
Lomachrome?
I've used some of the Lomachrome Purple. I've tried yeah. some of that film, because I really like working with, I did like working with color infrared when I was able to get it, you know, mm-hmm. years ago.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But Lomo Purple, I've tried some of that, and it's been good too. And again, coming back to that overcast light where it's kind of not, you know, completely sunny, but overcast, working at the lake, using some long exposure. So I've been exploring that right now with long exposures using filters.
How do you find the difference? So when you're out on your podcast on that episode, Notes from the Field, you were using a lensed camera with a 10 stop neutral density.
That's correct.
So how are you finding that sort of process? And quite a small, you had f22, I think I remember. So you were maximizing depth of field.
Yeah.
Why not just use a pinhole camera?
Well, there you go. Okay. Yeah, exactly. So that's what I need to do. That's a very good point. That's what I need to do, is bring out a pinhole and work with that. Yeah.
That was one of the things that got me into pinhole, was I was used trying to do really long exposures with, you know, the Lee big stoppers, you know, the 12 stop filters, and, you know, dealing with shake. And I don't know, after a while, I realized with the pinhole thing, I was like, oh, you know, like, geez, if it's just mildly cloudy, I could go ahead and get a minute exposure just by changing my film speed, you know, and like that kind of pulled me away from lens photography towards the pinhole side of it. Once I realized that.
I suppose with lensed photography, you know, you are with a medium or slow speed, you're going to get that, you know, much sharper image. And I know with Zero cameras and our Reality cameras, those pinholes are very professionally made, and the image they produce is, can be, particularly close up, can be razor sharp, and it's sometimes difficult to even realize it's a pinhole camera.
Yeah, Mike's cameras are like that. That camera I had from him, I could hardly even tell that it was even a pinhole, you know?
Yeah.
Especially if you have a good technique as far as your tripod and your movements, and, you know, and you have that down, and you're keeping your camera super still, it's even bitingly sharper, you know?
Yeah.
One of the themes, just not too long ago, for our darkroom group was pinhole photography. I wonder where they got that idea from. Anyway, so we made pinhole cameras, some of us, and I just took a 35 with some aluminium foil and made the pinhole that way, and then I tried different size pinholes and getting different type of images. But one of the members is extremely talented. Very, very, I think he might have been a machinist at some time, or he has a nice shop. And he really took it seriously and built a beautiful wooden pinhole camera and made his own pinholes. And so he took me over and showed me in his garage how he did this. And what he had is, he had a projector. He would put the pinhole in kind of a slide mount that he had made in an old projector and project the image on the white garage wall. And so you could see the size of the pinhole was, you know, projected. And you could see if there were any imperfections around it. And then he could take it back and do a little bit of fine work on it and put it back in the projector. And I saw him do that process, and it was amazing.
That's crazy.
So he wants to see some of the pinholes. Like, I purchased a set of pinholes a few years ago to use in homemade cameras, and he'd like to, you know, have a look at those and compare them to the ones he's doing.
You should check out the pinholes that James has, James Guerin. You can buy the pinholes separately in packs of different sizes, you know, and those pinholes he have, I'm not sure, is he making them, Andrew, or is he?
No, he's not. No, he's got someone doing it for him. They're laser,
but they're
drilled
the same way. Laser, they're like perfectly drilled round, you know. Like they are.
You know, that's another wonderful thing about pinhole photography, is that you can build your own camera. Like, you know, just
absolutely.
You can go to a secondhand store or a thrift store and look for old tins that people donate, and you could turn them into cameras or you know,
anything.
I know, that's one of the beautiful things about it, is like, you don't have to take this cookie cutter, you know, SLR, you can, you know, make a camera out of all kinds of different materials, you know, and use it in films or paper, or, you know, you could use paper. I have some 4x5 direct positive paper, and I've used that occasionally. So there's lots of possibilities to explore photography, you know, without a lot of batteries, you know, without electronics. It's just,
it's fun.
You know, really, really. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I quite like, this is a recurring theme on this podcast. We have guests on who make their own cameras, make their own pinholes, and some people just push a very fine darning needle through a piece of tinfoil and go for it. And I, whilst I've got these lovely commercial cameras with these biting sharp pinholes. I still get drawn towards those images, other people's work, the ones that are a little bit more
fuzzy.
fuzzy, to use a technical term.
Well, that was the nice thing about
pictorialist.
That was the nice thing about F295 is that, you know, it was always encouraging to see what other photographers around the world were posting as far as pinhole images were going, you know?
Now, so. Nick Voracek talked about F295, and I think you, for folks listening, you can still access it, I think, as a historic document, I believe, online if you type in F295.
So that was a large format group or just
pinhole? No, it was a pinhole group.
All pinhole. That was one of the first sites that I saw when I got back into pinhole. Like I said, I had made a successful pinhole image, and then I just forgot about it for years. And then I came back to it. You know, I saw an APUG, which is now Fortrio, you know, these advertisements, these banner ads, and I saw Zero Image. And I thought, okay, I'll give it a try again, you know, and then I never looked back.
Yeah.
So, Bob, you referred a couple of times to your darkroom group. Is that the same thing as when you talk about turning a room into a camera obscura in your classroom, or is there another angle to what you do? Do you do teaching?
Yes, I do. I'm a teacher. Yeah.
Right. That's what you do as a day job.
That's correct. Yeah. And then with the darkroom group, that's just a bunch of people around, you know, from, let's say, the Vancouver area all the way out to about Abbotsford here. And they just get together with the interest in darkroom work and working with darkroom prints and, you know, alternate processes like cyanotypes, platinum palladium, carbon printing, you know, all that kind of stuff. So and then we meet every fortnight. On Zoom right now because of the pandemic, and we just had a meeting last night. So, and we're just we did an exhibition here at the gallery at the Reach, and then we have one coming up in Surrey at the art gallery there. I think for starting in December. So, we're starting to
stretch. How many people do you get on a Zoom meeting then?
We usually get about anywhere from 9 to 11, something like that.
Okay, nice number.
Yeah, it's not a very big group.
I thought you were going to say, we get 75.
No, it's not a very big group. You know, I suspect everybody's gone over to the other side, you know, to the dark side. So there's not, I don't think there's many film people left. I think a lot of it's digital now, so.
The beauty of this technology that we've all discovered during lockdown is that suddenly you can have these sort of meetings with folks and they don't need to be in your neighborhood or your town. You know?
Yeah.
So some darkroom enthusiast sitting in the Cambridgeshire Fenlands could join your Zoom meeting. And if the time's married up and suddenly, suddenly I could be talking to you guys in Vancouver.
That's right. Yeah. I shouldn't say dark side. Digital is fine. It's a wonderful tool. But we do have a member from the island, from Vancouver Island. And she's an alternative process person and a wonderful photographer. And so it's the Zoom, the technology does allow for that to happen. So we used to have meetings here in the people's home. They have a room where we would meet, and then right next to it is a very nice big dark room. Got all kinds of stuff. Yeah.
I'd love to be part of a group which met physically like that. I mean, I meet loads of people, you know, photographers and not so many darkroom workers, but I do meet them. But
I find the critique really important. Like if you want to bring an image up, it's up to you, and people can comment on it, and they're very, very polite about it. But I find that when I've done that, it's been so, so helpful. It's just opened my eyes to something I didn't see right in front of me. And I'm just grateful for it, you know. And like I said earlier, it forces me to go back to the darkroom and see what I can do, how I can reinterpret this image and make it a little bit better.
Because you don't get that, do you, Corey, so much if you're posting on Instagram, and you and I both post on Instagram, definitely. And Bob does. You know, people are very kind, And I don't think they like mostly they don't sort of offer any critique at all, because it's a bit awkward, isn't it? Because someone's putting their work up there and they're not necessarily asking for critique, although sometimes they do.
So yeah, but a lot of times people put something up and then even if you do mildly critique it, they kind of are like, I wasn't asking you, you know, like that.
I did see one. Who do you think you are?
You know, I mean,
like, I saw one on Facebook. I think it was Facebook. It might have been Instagram. Who knows? Same sort of thing, where somebody had posted a lovely picture up, and it was the image as what they wanted to show. You know, quite clearly. You know, because they'd posted it, and someone took their image and they cropped it and says, "Oh, I hope you don't mind, but I've done this to it because I think this looks better." And the guy was just.
Murdered.
He was murdered. Yeah. In fact, I don't think he realized he would cause quite so much offense as he did.
Yeah. I too. You know, just listening, I think one of the differences too. This might be a part of it, maybe not. But if the person critiquing is someone you already know, like I say, in a group, that might be different than someone who you don't know making that same critique.
Yeah. Yeah.
So perhaps there's some difference there in how we perceive that. That critique.
I think
it's definitely different in a group where you're face to face. It's part of it, isn't it? It's a long-standing thing to have little salons of people and critiquing each other's work.
I've kind of gotten used to it because I had some classes in school, you know, and a lot of those classes we would have group critiques, so you kind of put something up in front of classmates and, you know, everybody says, what's wrong with it, you know? It's sometimes everybody says nothing, we all like it, and sometimes, you know, it's
begs a question as well, doesn't it? Because, you know, if you spent a lot of hours working on something and to you it says, the picture says what you want it to say, and then but to someone else they might say, well, you know, I'd have done it this way, I'd have done it that way. That's not necessarily saying that what you've done is wrong, is it?
Yeah. Well, the other good thing about and I think everyone should go to your local community college and just take some basic art critique classes, because after a while you start doing it yourself, and so before you just start releasing, you know, work that you've done, you can kind of sit down and put it into a series and think about it a little bit. You know, it's kind of hard to do that.
So
now
do you think it's useful, Bob and Corey? I'll ask you both because I think you both have an opinion. Do you think it's useful for photographers in general? Printmakers in the darkroom in general, pinhole photographers in general, to have not essential, but is it useful for them to have an appreciation of some of the history of art? Do you think?
I do. I took art history survey 1 and 2 and a couple of other classes, and while they were boring, I learned a lot of stuff that I didn't know. You know, I mean, like I think it is.
What about you, Bob? What do you think? Because you're a teacher, but are you teaching? Are you teaching photography?
No, I don't. I mean, I can incorporate it into my visual arts class,
right?
But not formally, not now. I have in the past at university level,
yeah,
but not now. But what would you
about whether you think, yeah, whether it's helpful to have some art education, if I can put it that way?
Well, that was kind of an epiphany for me a few years ago when I realized that art history and studying art, because being a visual art teacher, learning about this, it is really important, I think, to becoming or to helping become a better photographer. Absolutely. I think understanding art, understanding the elements and principles of art and how they can relate to the visual image, whether it's on canvas or whether it's on silver gelatin paper, I think is really, really important. So as I looked at that, it was another eye-opener in seeing how, oh my goodness, if you understand why the artist did this or why the artist did that, then that can help inform your photographic process as well.
And taking formal classes may not be absolutely necessary, but you're going to get it so condensed. You know, it'll take you years to go about it and finding the information out yourself on your own, you know.
Well, going to art galleries. I mean, going to London, going to the National Portrait Gallery.
Yep, you know? Yep.
Yeah, definitely.
I do a lot of self-study too, so I'll have books on different artists as well, and I'll be looking at them that way. And
Like, you know, Bob, just before we recorded, I was sitting in just in the next room, and I was reading a Taschen book called, which is all a collection of camera work photographs. And Camera Work was a publication that was started by, I think it was started by Alfred Stieglitz. Is that how you pronounce his surname? Stieglitz?
Yes.
Back in the 20s or the 30s. And this book has got a couple of essays in it, but it's mainly pictures, because you can go and still buy facsimile copies of Camera Work.
Yes.
You can buy the whole collection for about $1,200. I Googled it to see if you could get them. But Taschen does this book, and it's about £12, and it's a thick old book, and it's really good because it's full of these beautiful pictorialist style images, some famous ones like, of the Flatiron Building, but much of them are photogravure, which is a sort of photo mechanical process. But that, I was reading about that, and then it led me to, you know, look it up and just to see what was involved in it, and I decided that was far too complicated for me. But the images in there, they remind me of some lith prints that folks might do today, or, you know, but it's just a very interesting, I found it very interesting to look at all those images and think, well, actually, you know, not everything has to be pin sharp, clearly, because we're into the world of pinhole, aren't we? And boy, yeah. There's clearly nothing new.
Yeah, definitely.
It's a wonderful way to practice photography without a huge expense. Now, there is one more thing that does come to mind about pinhole photography, mm-hmm. and that is your shoulders and your legs. When I go out with my Toyo, I know you guys had talked about the pronunciation.
No, not on this show. That was on the large format.
Oh, that was the large format? Yeah, okay, yeah. All right. Yeah,
that's Toyo. Okay, though. You can mention it because I have the same camera.
Yeah, the Toyo. So if I go out with my Toyo, that's like 11 kilograms. That case is 11 kilograms with all my shoulders and my meters and my lenses. And if I go with the pinhole camera, that's probably less than a kilogram. So
yeah.
I mean, it's a lot friendlier on your shoulders when you're if you're doing any hiking or carrying your gear. So that's another good point about pinhole.
And if you take that zero image with the different extensions, or indeed Mike Walker's Titan camera with his different lens cones, I mean they just weigh nothing. They weigh nothing. Yeah.
That was a brilliant make too, the Titan Harmon, the 4x5. I have one of those, and that was a brilliant build. That was a nice. That's a nice camera. Yeah, I like that one too.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
So just very quickly, then, can I ask you a couple more things from your podcast? We touched on this before we started recording. You've actually spent some time during lockdown and done at least one online workshop with Alan Ross, who. It was a familiar name, but then you, in the next breath, you said he was the printer who studied with Ansel Adams, and he had some interesting things to say on technique and vision.
Yeah, he was. They're very. Yeah, I took a couple of workshops with him during that time period, and I had known about him that he was an assistant to Ansel Adams along with John Sexton, mm-hmm. and that he, I think he does all the printing. You know, those images that are still around. I think he does the printing for those. So it was really eye opening and such a friendly guy, but lots of information in a very quick time, right? Because you have about 60 minutes session. But I found it was very nice to, after you get over the awe that, wow, I'm talking to Alan Ross. It was pretty informative. So I was very grateful for that.
Mm. So he was saying in a way that technique is really important and understanding all that, but actually it's the next stage. It's how we use that technique to inform our vision. And without that, you know, you can have all the technique in the world, but it's pointless. And I think for me that comes to fruition in the dark room. For others, maybe not so. But it comes down to, you know, Alan prints all these pictures for Ansel Adams, and presumably he's printing them the way Ansel originally did. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any. Otherwise, they'd be here. So, what have you got thoughts on printing other people's work and how, if that's the fine, if that's so, the premise of the question, I suppose, is if printing a picture allows the expression to come through, and it allow you maybe discover new things in the, it's only when in the printing stage you, or indeed the scanning stage and time in the Lightroom, I suppose, as well. You're discovering new things about the negative that you weren't even, or about the image through the negative, because the in the darkroom, sometimes you put that negative in the enlarger and you start to notice the way light is falling in the print, and then your hands start to follow the light.
Exactly.
And so you end up interpreting this, the image on the print, or indeed Lightroom in, you know, on the computer, can end up remarkably different from, you know, the straight work print. And that's, a lot of people say, well, that's a bad thing, you should do everything in the camera, which I think is nonsense. But anyway, but if you then print other people's work, I wonder, is it necessary to have a, it must be necessary to have a close dialogue with the photographer to understand what it is, what message they're trying to put across?
I would imagine that they would be doing, if you couldn't speak to the original photographer, you know, I imagine you would be doing, from what I understand is Ansel had really detailed notes.
Yeah.
And he paid, you know, like with dodging and burning and everything, and split toning. So I'd imagine he would do a state of whatever, you know, Ansel has. But, you know, you have to remember, your light bulbs are never always the exact same strength. Even as they get older, they're changing. Your paper's changing. How long has your chemistry been sitting around? You know, how long has your paper been sitting around? So I don't know. To an extent, I guess. What, Bob, what do you think?
Oh, definitely. I think that's one of the things that I say. So I think it's an equation, you know, technique is only part of the equation, but, you know, bringing your creativity to that negative or to that, that mouse click, I think is going to be just as important. And that's, I mean, I guess that speaks to humanity, right? Like our creativity, each person, I think, has creativity to different degrees and in different ways of expression. And it's like, if like, for example, I really like Glenn Gould, right? And I like his interpretation of Bach's Goldberg Variations. But what if Angela Hewitt were to play Bach's Goldberg Variations? How would they be different from Gould's interpretation? So I think absolutely there's going to be a difference in interpretation of the negative for each printer. And so if I'm printing somebody else's work, which I wish I could, like I'd like to get a hold of some of the negatives for Vivian Meyer, for example, and try, you know, try to interpret them. And I've wondered about that, like if I could interpret, you know, one of or two of Ansel's negatives, what would it be like, and how would my interpretation be different from his interpretation? So I've wondered about that, but I've never had a.
Why don't you do it in your darkroom group? Would people be brave enough to
pass,
give negatives
pass
to each other?
Their negatives.
Yeah.
I think we talked about that or toyed with that idea a bit. I don't know where it's going. Well, it's kind of difficult right now. I think that might have come up at one point.
You could do like a blind draw, have everybody send you their negatives and just everybody pick a number. Okay, here's a negative. What was with your number?
Well, print. You remind me, and who was it? Somebody took, made a few infrared negatives online. This was a couple of years back, and I've lost, I'm sure I haven't lost the negative. I must have it somewhere. And he sent the negative out to willing people who wanted to make a print from this negative. It was pretty much the same negative as much as he could duplicate it. And he was very interested in sending it to willing participants of this project. Goodness me, I'm really sorry if you're listening. I can't remember who sent me the negative. And the idea was that you were supposed to make a print, but and then he was going to put them all together to see what different interpretations people had on it. And I was so intrigued by it, and I got the negative, and I have to confess to have not done anything with it.
But that's a brilliant idea. That's a really brilliant idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've got to try and have. I suppose if you go out in the field with that idea, then it's quite easy. Particularly, I think these were, and I think they were 35mm negatives. But say, you could produce 12 120, just bang off 12 shots, couldn't you? 1, 2, 3, 4 of the same scene while the light was still stable. And then you cut them up and send them to 12 different people and says, well, let's be interested to see what you make of it. Then you could put them together in a little zine or something, couldn't you?
Yeah.
Yep.
With a pinhole camera, of course, right? A pinhole.
Well, with a pinhole camera, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, maybe
no,
that's the thing.
Not with
we
any
could
of
do.
This lens nonsense.
No. So you're in one of your blog posts, you talk about turning your classroom into a camera obscura, which isn't a new thing. But tell us, who were you revealing this bit of witchcraft to? Then this suddenly that you can make a camera out of a building. That was some students of yours, was it?
Yeah. It was. We have at the end of the year, we have an exhibition of learning. So performing arts would put on something, and you know, different classes may do different things. Yeah. And so what I wanted to do was to, you know, redo the camera obscura. I know there's a guy named Abe. What's his? Oh, Abe. Oh, I can't think of his name. I think he's from South America. He would go to hotel rooms and he would turn the hotel room into a camera obscura.
Yeah.
I can't remember his family name now. Anyway, I was, you know, on, you know, looking at that and looking at the history of the camera obscura.
Is that Morel? Is that, was that
Morel? That's it.
Abramo Morel or something, isn't it? Yeah.
That's right. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So going back to that, looking at that, I thought, this would be a really neat thing to do with my classroom. I just have these three windows I have to block out, so I better start saving up cardboard. And then I made my own aperture, like on a dial. I made a couple of different apertures, and the first thing I did is I tried it out just before World Pinhole Photography Day. I think it was in 2020. I tried it out in a bedroom in my home, just to, you know, work it all out. And then from there, I kept the aperture and I took it to school and turned a classroom into a camera obscura to share with the school. And the principal came, the vice principal came, and other people came. They thought that was quite cool being able to do that, you know, have a look at outside. And we could even see Mount Baker off in the distance in the United States. We could see that. So
were you tempted to paste some sheets of Ilford Multigrade on the wall and try and capture some of that image?
Ooh, it never occurred to me, but now, now they've got the idea. What I was able to show them now, using different apertures, how it affected the sharpness of the image. So because it's on a turret, I was able to shift it and show them that.
There would be an optimum pinhole size for that particular focal length, wouldn't it?
Right. Well, it, you know, combining the pinhole, the aperture, and we had a large frame with a white sheet on it, and we can move that back and forth as well in the classroom. So that, you know, combining the different aperture with the focal length, you know, we knew do that, you know, make it sharp. And oh, look at that so-and-so's car, or that so-and-so's car. Oh, look at that. Someone's walking across. You know, it's really neat to be able to show them that.
But I like the idea of if you're teaching pinhole photography, because, you know, you can go and you can work it out from mathematics, or you can go online and go to Mr. Pinhole's site, say, and type in what your focal length is. I don't make any apologies for saying focal length, but you know what I mean. And it gives you the optimum pinhole size, you know, which is great to give the optimum sharpest image.
Yeah,
and then but there's nothing to stop you varying away from that to get more pictorial effects, more fuzzy effects.
Yeah, absolutely.
What a way to demonstrate that in practice, to have someone in a room and say, well, actually, this is what this is telling you, is that there is, for every focal length, there is an optimum size.
Yes. And you guys are sitting inside a camera right now.
Yeah, pretty much.
How cool is that? You know, you're sitting inside a camera. You know, I like the idea about keeping it simple, too. Like when I taught pinhole photography at university, a couple of classes, it was all about, you know, we learned a little bit about the history and the United States Air Force Base, where they have converted it into the largest pinhole camera in the world. And we looked a little bit at that, and then building pinholes and working with pinholes and working in the darkroom. So it was just, you know, keeping it fun and not getting into a lot of the mathematics or the science.
No, that's quite right. Yeah.
But focusing on that aspect. And I mean, if people are further interested, of course, that can come later on down the road, if they're still interested and they want to go forward with it.
Well, when you look at Fox Talbot's picture of Laycock Gabby through the window, I mean, there's nothing sharp about it, is there? You know, but it's the magic of having an image on a piece of paper.
Yes. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
One last question, because when you were due to come on the show back in the summer, I did go on the Facebook group and ask people, oh, Bob's coming on, Follow the Light podcast. And I think Neil Piper, bless him, was the only one to ask a question. And I know he's asked the same question, because you're going to be appearing on Negative Positives podcast in a couple of days. But we've got you first, so I'm going to ask. And I did say to Neil, hey, you've asked that question already, and we haven't had a chance to ask him yet. So Neil said he's very happy for you to answer the question twice. So tell us about the plesiosaur, because I remember you did a post, I can't remember what it was about, but it was something to do with the dinosaur. Yeah.
Okay. I'll try to be quick. My undergraduate work is in archaeology, anthropology. I really like archaeology. I was actually on my first dig. My last week of high school, I was on my first dig, and paleo is some of the oldest material we find on the prairie. Mm-hmm. And so I was able to do that. And then I was kind of going in other directions, but really wanted to keep up with that. One of my mentors, and where I grew up, was quite seriously into archaeology and knew a lot of the top names in the province. And we used to work together. So we did some ethnographic studies together. Like making pemmican and trying to recreate that as best we could with what we have, things like that. Or we'd go checking out sites, you know, where there's blowouts in the farmer's fields, where the wind blows it out and it's kind of hard, blows off the topsoil a little bit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, usually you can see where there's maybe a black part where there might have been a fire pit, or you find lithics, broken pieces of arrow points, that kind of thing. And then there was another area near the town where I grew up that also had a creek flowing through it and hills. We call it the Tillet Hills area. And in there, I was just hiking along at the bottom of a cut bank and found this piece of material. And I wasn't sure what it was, but it didn't look natural. So I took it to this friend of mine who knows about archaeology, and he sent it off to Regina, and they sent back a picture of a almost complete reconstruction of a long neck plesiosaur skull. And that initiated an excavation. Unfortunately, I wasn't there for that. I was away at that time, but it did, and they got most of it. And I understand it's the rarer type. There's a short neck and a long neck, and this was the long neck. So it was quite a significant find.
So if it was an original thing that had never been discovered before, they could have called it a Saint Cirasaur.
Yeah, it's got a very long name. I think there was a Japanese paleontologist, or she might have been a student, who did the research on this, and I looked it up because I've done a couple of reports for the Saskatchewan government on fossil material, on paleontology, and so I reference her work in that, because I've since found other material in the area, and under the Heritage Property Act, you know, it belongs to the Crown. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it has to go through a filing and a permit process. So,
yeah. Well, nothing to do with pinhole photography, but at least we got to the bottom of that eventually.
There you go.
What an eclectic conversation. We haven't even talked about specific images, but it's been a real pleasure. Corey.
Definitely.
All right. I was handing it back to you, boss.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well,
it's okay.
I guess, yeah. Bob, thanks for coming and talking with us.
Well, thank you guys for having me. It's been a real pleasure. I really appreciate it. You know,
photography is
great.
It's been lovely. Yeah, thank you very much.
I would say, Andrew, do you have any more questions? But I know that you do have more questions.
I do.
You can talk more, sir.
I did have a few more, but I've got to go and cook steak now.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, thanks for coming, Bob, and we'll talk to everybody again next time.
Soon.
Yep.
Yep. Okay.
Thanks, guys. Take
Thanks,
care.
Thanks, Bob. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Size, so there's no excuse to just sit around.
Do you hear that, Andrew? You have no excuse to sit around.
Oh, I don't sit around. She doesn't need as many walks as she used to, because, in fact, I read somewhere, you know, if the dog is having trouble with the bladder, that...
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the podcast. This is a solo show with just myself and Andrew, and we are going over the Holga Week pinhole submissions.